Honorable Deputy Minister, DG, Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, and all distinguished ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is Latsi Maloka. I'm the board chairperson of NEMISA, and with me, I'm with Dr. Veso, the acting CEO, and with Ms. Moira Malakalaka across the room, who's the CFO. Please don't mind my voice. I've got a bit of flu. It's an honor, chairperson, for us to be invited here to present our annual financial report for 2013-2014. And we'd like to thank and acknowledge the support and the guidance and the leadership that we've received from both the PCC and the department. And as the board, we'd also like to thank and acknowledge the hard work and contribution by the executives, the staff, and all the stakeholders in ensuring the delivery on the National E-Skills Agenda, which is the mandate of NEMISA and INEM. I'd like to say that we've made some major leaps in the past financial year, 2013-2014, with a lot of challenges, especially on the resources and the budgetary constraints. And one of the other challenges, the most important one, being the appointment of the CEO, which has taken us over a year to actually address. It's a very important matter that the board is looking at with the support from the department, and we are currently underway with appointment. And we're hoping that by end of November we'll have sorted out that issue. The other challenge that we've had in the past year, which was in a way a good problem, was the fact that we were integrating three institutes. And during that whole process, members are aware of the fact that much as we were integrating the three institutes, we still had a program running with the current students with NEMISA. So while we were busy integrating, we still had programs running, so it's not like we were able to stop and then start. From the annual report, just a bit of summary with regards to the HE's report. Members are aware again that it was the first time this year that we had an integrated APP with all three entities, and that's also proved to be a bit of a challenge in terms of the performance information. And in terms of repeats of last year's findings, there were no repeats, and we're working towards a clean administration for the following years. I'll just give my team the chance to take over before my voice gives up on me. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Maloka. And good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Minister, DG, colleagues. I was told to only have 10 slides, and we adhered to that, so it's really high level, and with the assumption that the report was read. Just by way of introduction, in terms of our report, the Chief Executive Officer's report, I think we need to just provide a very broad context for the report. And that is that whatever we do in the E-Skills Institute or the MISA is actually actually building e-astuteness. Now there is, I've circulated terms of concepts that we're using in the report to board members, to committee members. And e-astuteness is actually developing in people an attitude and the consciousness of the 21st century, essentially a society in which ICTs are playing a very important role. And within that context, whatever we develop, and I must also emphasize that the courses that we develop, the research we're trying to do, are all new courses that we develop in collaboration with many stakeholders. And fundamental questions that we ask when we develop this material is, what impact will e-skilling have on unemployment, on inequity, and on poverty? I don't think we're just skilling people for the sake of skilling. We've done that for far too long. Also, and you will see in my brief report, for us it is about collaboration, that no single institution can deliver the skills that we need in this country by 2030. As we all know that by 2030, according to the NDP, we need to be an e-literate society. It's also very important that we're responsive, and this will become clear later on, and that we also a catalyst, in other words, that we catalyze other institutions to deliver on e-skills. Major achievements for this year is the increase in number of e-skills stakeholders, targeted new courses that we've developed, increased research capacity across the country. We've increased the awareness, in particular at the provincial level, and a better analysis of impact data to influence policy. We are a new institution, and we need to have also, you know, within every year, a little forward look perspective. We still have to, of course, in going into the future, align collective e-skills efforts, develop evidence-based policy regarding skilling, youth intervention, and of course a major problem for the institute, funding, and I will talk about that later again. And then I think during this review period, I think we had staff that worked very, very hard with limited resources to deliver what we had to deliver. Just a high-level environmental scan, the environment in which we operate, and that we always have to keep in mind, because the institute is very much forward-looking whilst dealing with current problems. I think that's important for us, that we have to keep in mind what the world in 2050 will be like, and what South Africa will be like in 2050, and unpack that backwards to understand what we have to deliver proactively, and also how we deal with the current shortages as far as e-skills are concerned in the country. We all know the World Economic Forum report showing that our e-readiness ranking is on a decline over the past 10 or so years. There's also other reports that I think is very important to take note of, and that's the recent McKinsey report talking about the IGDP, in other words, the internet economy. And in some countries, the internet economy contributes to GDP at about 6%. In South Africa, the contribution of the internet economy is about 1.4%. And very fundamental to this internet economy, or e-commerce, some people also will call it, is, you know, the extent to which people have skills to utilize the internet. There are also very interesting other reports, you know, the contribution that women can make to the GDP once they get the appropriate skills and have access to the internet. And I think that is something that we have to keep in mind as well. We also have to understand internationally, there's a shift away from building e-skills for the ICT sector towards e-skills for society as a whole. And that is where we will be in 2050, is that all our people, or most people, will have to be e-skilled in order to survive in that world. A report indicates that by next year, 90% of jobs available in Europe will require e-skills. So it's very important that we have a national intervention in dealing with skills going into the future. And then also the integration of ICT across various disciplines is no longer only about IT or ICT, but really all disciplines, from history to physics, will have to have e-skills within that context. Continentally, we understand that we're falling behind. There's also an interesting understanding of e-skills, and we're working with a few countries in Africa around providing e-skills human capacity leadership. So that is, I mean, there is an opportunity for us to become involved there. Locally, I think the Institute is gaining traction amongst the key stakeholders across government, business, education, civil society, and I'll talk about that. The Institute's model of collaboration allows key stakeholders in the country to become actively involved, and we have we're doing very well on that side. And also, I think very important is that we, in some way, also starting to catalyze universities and other institutions to understand what e-skills, what it is about, and how they start changing what they're doing. Just one slide on giving you a sense of the key programs and what they mean. It was very difficult for us the past year, 2 years, to promote what I can call an e-skills discourse in the country. I think, you know, 3-4 years ago, people said, but what's an e-skill, what are you doing, and where are you going? But I think more and more in policy documents, in the private sector, in society, people are now understanding what e-skills are about. There's a difference between an e-skill and a computer skill, or an IT skill and an e-skill, and I gave you the terms that we define. So right at the bottom, and there's not hierarchy, but very important, if we want to deliver on e-skills, is multi-stakeholder collaboration. Collaboration between government departments, the private sector, civil society, education, and so on. We need to mobilize whoever can deliver e-skills in the country to deliver that. We have to massify, if we want to be an illiterate society, you know, that we have to massify the e-skilling of our people. And in this collaboration with the different constituencies, of course, we build our teaching and our learning. We build our curricula, we build our research programs. And you know, research and innovation, or I would also rather call it research for innovation, that is very important. That not only are we trying to give the basic skills to people, but also we need to get to a level where we, within the ICT space, that we innovate. And that is what the future world is about. If we don't have an innovative environment, an innovative society, we're falling behind, because that is what will differentiate future economies. And then lastly, program 4 is about aggregation, monitoring and evaluation. We're trying to monitor and to evaluate right from the start, rather than wait for 10 years to pass by and then trying to understand what we have achieved, where did we make mistakes, and what was the impact of our activities. And that is for government, as we all know, very, very important. It's no longer managing and measuring numbers, but it's managing and measuring outcomes and impact. And so we appreciate that, and that is what we have put together. We have now developed a very sophisticated model that will tell us in our e-skilling of people how we impact on poverty, how we impact on unemployment, and so that kind of monitoring is important. Otherwise, it's not that we have to play or need to play a numbers game. I think that is very, very easy. In our performance, in our report, under performance, you will find all the tables. What I've done here is actually to extract the what we have delivered in 2013-14. Now you will see in our report, almost everywhere, in every as far as every deliverable is concerned, is either lack of funds or a delay in funding, not having the resources, and I can see, and I can, you know, it was very, very difficult, and the chairperson mentioned it also, you know, to manage the integration of three entities and at the same time to deliver new things, build a capacity, was not very easy. But despite all the problems that we've experienced, I think we can show that we have delivered. We could have done much better. I think it's also important to understand that we only received funding for 13-14 in November, December of that year. And you can understand the end of the academic year is in December, so we had to do all sorts of things to get to these numbers during the year. And I will take you through a few aspects of this table, as per the program and as per the collabs that we have in the country. Here we have 6 collabs, and you will see here each with a specific thematic area. You know, ICT for rural development, creative new media, e-governance, connected health, knowledge in society, e-literacy and e-astuteness, and also e-inclusion and social innovation. Now these things are directly linked to the National Development Plan, the medium-term strategic framework, and government strategies in general. We have to deliver skills in these areas, and we still have to establish 3 more collabs, and we are about to finalize that in the Northwest Province, and then the Free State and Mpumalanga, we will have to see what we do there. But if we look at multi-stakeholder collaboration and the numbers against that, those numbers indicate the number of collaborators, whether they're from the private sector, government, government departments, provincial government, civil society, business, and so on. So those are people directly impacting on the work that we're doing, and making sure that when we develop programs, it's not from a one-side academic perspective, but really understand the needs out there in developing our work. And we, of course, formalize wherever we can our partnerships. In teaching and learning, the numbers you see there is during the year at different levels, from diploma level, from diploma level right down to e-literacy courses in communities, we've impacted about 3,500 people. Of course, we're developing targeted courses, and again, you can see the numbers there, and the number of learners trained and impacted. And of course, also, we've identified what we call smart community knowledge centers. It's not only about giving people access, but really utilizing existing centers where you can build e-students and where you can get people to effectively use ICTs, not only with a job in mind, but also to improve their quality of life. I think that is also very important. We don't just teach people to go into a job, but we also need them to use ICTs to improve their quality of life. Research and innovation, we have a number of research projects that we had in that year. What is interesting is the interest at a PhD level. So we, and especially in Gauteng, where we hosted by the University of Pretoria, there were about 10 PhD students that we could get them to tweak their research to become e-skills related. And I think that is important that we don't spend money or put money into more students, and the more we train, the more unemployed they are. But really, we see how can we collaborate with universities and other institutions to make their research relevant for our purposes. Of course, we have a number of publications on e-skills in academic journals done by our colleagues in the collaborative laboratories, the CoLabs. If everything goes well and we can get a funding, we envisage that this year we would publish the first book on e-skills. And colleagues in the CoLabs, I mean, that we all contributing to chapters in books and international research. What is very important is mobile applications development. I think we're very successful, and I think, as we all know, that is where the world is going, apps development. And we at the moment have three what we call applications development factories. One hosted by our CoLab in Gauteng, focusing on multimedia and so on. One in the Western Cape, and one in the Eastern Cape, hosted by Walter Sisulu University. And I think with apps development, we're very successful. We could prove that to develop a mobile app, nowadays you don't need a computer science degree. We have done work with school children. We've developed courses in apps development, and we have partnerships with BlackBerry, RIM. We have partnerships with Apple. Our Western Cape factory worked very closely with Apple in developing iOS software. The one from, of course, BlackBerry software. And I think this is really also give our students an opportunity. It's about job creation as well. I mean, you can if you clue it up, you can develop a very good application in your bedroom and you can make millions of rand. So I think that is where we have to really focus. Advocacy and awareness, that is a problem. I think we're doing well at a very local level and provincial level, but I don't think we have the finance or the funds to really advocate and create awareness at a national level. We have campaign workshops. We work with the ministers, deputy ministers, when they go on their engagements. And we have mobile apps development campaigns. I think, you know, in Gauteng we reach out to 1,400 students already, and university students are actually be impacting on that side as well. And our factory in the Western Cape in that year, 150 students. And what again is interesting is that the students developing the best applications are actually not science or computer science students. They are people from faculties of law, faculties of arts. So I think what is important first to understand the problem. We also get people, students from communities. We talk about social and e-inclusion, social innovation. Only when you understand what you want to achieve and you get the basics to develop an app, you can develop an app that is useful for your local community. And I think that is when we talk about e-students. It's not developing an application for the world, but an application that a taxi driver can use an application that our gogo, our grandmother, our grandfather can use and improve their quality of life by using local developed applications. So that is just to give you a sense under very difficult circumstances. We've done this work, we have the model, and if you remember correctly, last year I told that we have in place a model that can impact 10 million people in this country over the next 5 years. With appropriate funding, with the collaboration with other government departments, working very well with other government departments, with business and with civil society, we can, according to our model, and we've done the research, impact 10 million people in the country from PhD students right down to people in our communities to become e-students, illiterate over the next couple of years. There is just I can't proceed. This is about the last from my side. It's just going forward, I think, just briefly, based on our work that we've done, the minister requested us to develop a business case, and fundamentally a business case to get the appropriate funding for the institute, and also to develop in future, if the minister approves, enabling legislation for the institute, and I think the third bullet there is very important to us, that we can only do all of these things once we have the appropriate funding. I know that money is scarce, but that is why we have to focus on collaboration, to work with business, other government departments, civil society, to get this whole thing going. Then the next is the I manage human resources in the next few slides to Moira. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Thank you for the opportunity to present. I'm going to start with human resources from the annual report. The human resources is on page 49 of your annual report. The oversight of this report is done by the Human Resources and Remuneration Committee. And this is the overall, it shows that the overall picture of the organizations with regards to number of approved posts that we've got. We had 57 approved posts. And at the end of the financial year, we had 43 posts filled. The posts that were vacant were with regards to senior management, which also became vacant at the end of the financial year, at the end of quarter, the last quarter, which was the post, maybe out of the top of my mind, the chief operations officer, the company secretary, and procurement manager. But that all happened at the end of the last quarter of the financial year. The posts were important, and there are posts that are important. All the posts that were in approved, the human resources, however, and the board actually decided that we fill the critical posts, and they approved a governance structure, as you can see on the Human Resources and Remuneration Committee, that would take the new institute forward, looking into the fact that we had two institutes coming together, one from the ESI branch and the one on NIMISA, on how we can actually leverage and posts from both sides, not to duplicate at the same time as we were merging. The board approved an interim government structure for 2013-2040 to put in place so that the institute is able to deliver on its current APP and strategic plan. We've highlighted a couple of graphs there that looks at performance rewards, personal cost by salary bands, and personal cost per program, and training costs that were engaged during the year. So from that point of view, we could see from a point of view of
what we have actually missed and what we have control over, what, how did we spend in terms of our human resources and remuneration. In terms of corporate governance can find it on page 43 of the annual report. We have a functioning board, and we have also three committees that I assist in the board. That's the audit committee, the audit and risk committee, the human resources and remuneration committee, and what we call the academic committee. The audit committee obviously looks at the, it's the primary responsibilities for governing the internal and external auditors, the risk management, the financial information and performance information. The Human Resources and Remuneration Committee will have oversight regarding human resources, as I said, and remuneration, and also the Academic Committee, which looks at, which is responsible for advice to the board on matters relating to the teaching and learning and their strategic goals and key performance area, and the APP to carry the performance information of the Institute forward. The corporate, during the year, the board has approved a code of conduct. These are some of the highlights from the report. The board approved a corporate code of conduct along with the supply chain code of conduct as a link. This was part of our strategic plan, well, not a rather strategic plan, but our action plan going forward, so that we don't into working towards a clean administration. So this assisted also to make sure that we train the staff and we train everybody in the organization to work what we mean by business, operating a fair business which is impartial and ethical and in a proper manner with full compliance with laws and regulations. So we started from there as part of the to take responsibility for everyone to take responsibility for carrying out the key administration plan and also in terms of internal control. The board also approved a health and safety policy that was aimed at maintaining a safe and healthy environment, some of the things that they did in terms of corporate governance. And we also looked at the risk management as part of the strategy that was approved by the board, that we have a fraud prevention plan, and whilst implementing the fraud prevention plan, we had administered a free hotline for people to be able to communicate any irregularities. So these were part of the things that, as a whole, in terms of corporate governance, looking into internal controls, how best can we actually ensure that we get to a point where we have a clean administration that with no findings in terms of compliance and laws and regulations, and that can actually sustain the organization going forward. So the next slide is the report of the Board and Audit Risk Management Committee. The what we call the BAC, which is the Audit Committee, essentially they have adopted a charter during the year. One of the things, the activities that they did during the year was also the evaluation of annual financial statements as they stand now. They have adopted a risk management they've adopted and assisted in actually ensuring that there is a functioning risk management in terms of the organization. We have had as a new institute had a workshop on new emerging risks, and if the risks that were there only relating to NEMISA, are they the risks that are still relevant for the new institution? So we had actually had a risk, then we ensured that we had a risk workshop. In terms of internal control, the audit committee also works towards an approach of combined assurance, so that there's management, external and internal assurance with regards to internal controls. And we had also, they had also looked at the work of the internal auditors and evaluated the performance of the internal auditors of the institution. The internal audit section, of course, is outsourced to OCA. In terms of the annual financial statements and the report to the directors, for the chairperson, for the first time, the institute has managed to actually get a surplus. This was not without any difficulty, but we had in the previous years came to the PCC and said we are working towards reducing the cost and leveraging some of our cost towards ensuring that we can keep on doing what we're doing, but with ensuring that we keep the organization sustainable. We had a net surplus of about, and this is starting from page 65 of the annual report, we had a net surplus of about 500,000, and we as opposed to the loss of, to the net loss of that we did, that we had net deficit that we had last financial year. This is with regards that we tried a strategy whereby we kept some costs the same, looking at the fact that now that we're going into the new institute, the revenue also had to go down a little bit because we were trying to accommodate everything in the new institute and also ensuring that we deliver and we do not actually compromise on our delivery and quality of our delivery. We also ensured that we made sure that all the students that we have in terms of individuals, in terms of debtors, most of our debtors will not be able to actually pay us back. So what we did is that we had the institutions like our MICT, CETA, and other institutions like Telkom who are interested in taking back the graduates who would actually pay their fees. There are lots of other institutions that we approached that sponsored the students, so that made it a bit easier for the institution. In ensuring that we're keeping the costs down, we could see that we only, in terms of operation, in total income received for the year, we had 42 million as opposed to 40 million last year, and which is an increase of about 2 million. But in terms of operating expenditure, you could see that we're actually trying our best to actually keep it the same, in spite of the fact that we have increases in terms of inflationary increases every year. But we try to actually make sure that we can cut most costs that we don't actually need. The additional incomes comes from projects that we had and which we had signed off at the end of the last quarter, although this income was minimal to assist with supplementing the deficit and ensuring that we carry on with the operations. The next slide, Chairperson, is with regards to the report of the Auditor General. So we had a unqualified report. This is an unqualified report, but we had, like all the other years, we tried to get away from getting compliance paragraphs. The only time that we're seeing our action plans working is actually the last financial year, where we only had a compliance paragraph on performance information. Merely because, and I think the chairperson highlighted this, is that this was the first time that we had a new APP that we were working on and delivering on, and it had a lot of challenges with regards to where does it fit. And for us, it actually assisted us a lot to actually work on a new APP 1516 that actually is understandable and is quantifiable and is we able to deliver on it and not repeat this finding on performance information. And we hope that with this thing of clean administration, with the strategy that we have for clean administration, that the next report on Auditor General, it will be a clean report now that we're going to take care of the, we have taken care of the performance information. And how we did it was that when we developed the 14-15 APP, we ensured that we worked together with the Auditor General and we engaged them before we actually submit to the department the end of January this year. And also our internal auditors had a look at our APP to ensure that it meets what we call the SMART principles and the National Treasury Guide on Performance Information. So Chairperson, that's as far as I'm going with the, but yeah, we had only that on predetermined objectives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think for maybe just to open more, and I think DG is still here. DG, most of the things that are said in the annual report is that their transfer happened on the third quarter. Yeah, it's a bit worrying, because for me it makes it difficult to hold them accountable, because most of their targets, they are saying they are not able to achieve their targets because money was transferred late to them. Maybe let's get that out of the way so that we can be able to deal with their performance issue.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think let's just be factual. NEMISA has got an allocation. The transfer that they're talking about is money that from the department, we're then saying, how do we assist them? We've been engaging with National Treasury. Unfortunately, we've not been successful in our discussions with Treasury for them to be allocated a lot more than what they have. What we give them also compromises the department, hence the earlier discussions in terms of when we're presenting the annual report of the department, where certain things you find that we sacrifice what needs to be done in the department for them. It's not a sustainable plan that we have on the table, hence why even the issue when Minister was of the view that let's rather have a proper business case that we can argue with National Treasury form of funding. The solution to resolve the challenges of NEMISA is to get an allocation from National Treasury. But what we also said, because Treasury sees that there's no new money, Honorable Chairperson. We need, with whatever we want, all these new things that we are coming up with, we have to shift money around. Now, the issue that we put down on for the entity is that they need to help us to be innovative, like the earlier discussion that we had about the Dordegna, where we can look at other innovative ways of funding them from the private sector. Currently, the S is of them to want to have this big business plan that depends on the budget of the department is not possible. I've raised it with Dr. Viz that I don't have the powers as an accounting officer to be moving everything of the department, to shut down the department so that the NEMISA can sustain, which is more like what they're proposed. It's not possible, Honorable Chairperson. There are realities of what we are dealing with from a fiscal point of view. There's no new money.
Thanks for that clarity. I think DM, this one needs the executive assistance, that there's a need for trying to sit down and get it right, because it becomes difficult for us to do an oversight. How do I say to NEMISA when they are raising these things? So it doesn't assist us to be able to do our oversight. I think from where I'm sitting, and I'm going to allow members, I just thought, let me just get this one, because it becomes difficult when you see the annual report says we were not able to do this because the money was transferred. I mean, it's almost on a number of their targets in terms of their annual performance. If you look at the annual performances right through, I mean, I think it's from page 34, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, somewhere 33, 34, all that around, when you look, majority of their targets were not achieved. And out of that explanation, it says this is what. So for me, I think what it calls for is sitting around the table, maybe even assisting DG. I'll give it to speak. Maybe even assisting in terms of just getting, if there are certain things that we must take out, what is it that we need to take out, and what is it that we need to remain with a limited budget, and just try around and. If there are other avenues to be able to find money, let's try and find money. But as well, because for me it will become difficult if they are to come back, because these are the issues that we'll have to clarify as we go forward to the strat plans early next year, because we'd have to have a better understanding of what we want to achieve with this entity and how are we going to make sure that it's financially sustainable, we provide the support that it. I noted you, DM, just to say something, and then I'm going to give members to just comment. Let me just give DM to speak on this one.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we are all in agreement that this is a very, very important initiative in terms of all the things that we have been saying about the question of skills and even inclusive growth. But I think, Chairperson, even before we look at money, some of the challenges we're dealing with here, maybe it's difficulties with the policy direction, because remember, Treasury, when they fund, to a large degree, they are influenced by the vision of the enabling department. In this instance, I think the NAMISA, the vision of that administration, which came up with the idea, was realistic and critical. I'm not sure whether then at that time the initiative has been taken through, backed through policy and legislation, so that the status of the entity is clear as to what status is it. Because in the absence of that, Treasury is going to find difficulties in supporting them. But from our new leadership administration point of view, I know the minister was more excited about NAMISA than I was, because he saw it as a solution. So I agree with the chairperson. We need to quickly go back and work at this. At one point, we're even looking at collaboration with some existing resources within the system, like money under NESFAS for special projects. But again, you get that depending on the motivation of the enabling department. So we have to sort out a few things from a policy point of view, the legislation, and to find a way, because it's not even a side issue. It's one of our critical responsibilities to skill people. We can't talk SMME without talking how to skill those people to be able to enter the sector. And I'm sure with clear clarity, even the industry could. I know when I went for the graduation, I could see the industry is interested. Sometimes they take their short projects, but we need to do more so that Parliament, the committee, can be able to measure performance. Thank you.
Let's just get the members so that if the issues as well to assist. Okay. Honorable Mackenzie, Honorable Sotit, Honorable Shea, Honorable Dunyan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I heard a lot of talk during the presentation about funding and the lack of funding. When we bear in mind that the funding we're talking about is taxpayers' money, when I go through this report, I get concerned by a number of issues, and if I can deal with them one by one. First, if I compare it to other entities that we're funding, entities with reasonably small budgets like ZADNA, and the amount of money that's paid to directors, I look here and I see directors' emoluments amounting to around 4 million rand. That's 10% of the revenue or the grant of taxpayers' money of 42 million that we're spending on directors. In fact, the amount is 4,189,000 rand, including travel expenses. So I would like to know, given the size of this company, what justifies that kind of expenditure on directors? There's also an amount, and I'm looking at statement of financial performance. I'm trying to find the page number for you. Sorry, Chairperson, please bear with me. On notes 14, under expenditure, the directors' emoluments, and then there's an amount for consulting of 1,486,000. What does that relate to, given the... certainly the President made a comment about the use of consultants. Then I have to compare... let me go back to the directors' emoluments. Centec emoluments for directors is 7.7 million rand with 11 directors. Broadband Infraco is 6.9 million with 11 directors. And here we're looking at an entity with a revenue of 42 million that's paying over 4 million rand for its directors. And there was another figure that jumped out at me. Notes in the statements, staff cost refreshments, 297,000 rand. I don't even think MPs eat that kind of money. 297,000 rand. But the number of staff members you have, it works out to 7,000 rand per staff member for staff refreshments. A company this size, you'd think you'd pack your own sandwiches. There's also an amount, an insurance amount of 1.455 million, almost 1.5 million. And that the total reconciliation of your property, plant, and equipment is 2.861 million. What is the 1.5 million in insurance covering? That seems to be quite a bit of your budget. And then lastly, the HR director spoke to the receivables, and that receivables could not, you know, you couldn't claim the money back. If you're going into it with that kind of attitude, why are you invoicing people if you know that the money's never going to be recovered? Then you might as well just call it a grant instead of an invoice and just give it away. Because that seems like what you're doing when your age trade receivables over 90 days are sitting at 5.5 million. So please, if you can explain that as well. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Just to correct something Honourable Mackie said, I don't think it's appropriate to say they must pack their sandwiches. Let's use correct language. I think we can question the amount, but I certainly believe that every company, when they have meetings, they're entitled to have refreshments, not to carry sandwiches. Let's proceed, members.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Chairperson, your comments on the presentation, coupled with the explanation by both DG and Deputy Minister, is actually disempowering in as far as the question is concerned. However, I want to see clarity on one or two points. That as you popularize the hotline, what is your approach to ensure that the information reaches even poor communities where the rate of, or the level of education is very low for them to know about the hotline? And the surplus that you have alluded to can convince us that it didn't happen at the expense of this delivery. Sometimes we talk about the surplus when we actually have an underspend. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. My reservations about the about NAMESA and its success, and I think it's been quite well known. Because I think there's a grandiose plan here. There's a lot of good ideas here, but they're not something that the taxpayers should be funding. My view is that perhaps it should be shrunk to being at the most a directorate in the department that actually acts as a as an advisor and coordinator of private sector and senior and other educational institutions and research entities. I don't think that this should be operational in the field at all. I think it should be an advisory thing. And you know, one knows that obviously a lot of the targets weren't met, and we've got the fact that there was no funding, but all the Auditor General's findings are about the lack of accountability for what money they do get, and the quality of its management. So, you know, it really is, I think, a grand idea, but perhaps in the wrong hands. Now we talk, I'm going on to the annual report, page 88. Now, bearing in mind that a lot of the programs couldn't be implemented because there was no money, and that at the end of the year everything was overspent. Can we please explain why there were, A, 13 checks paid to staff, why there were staff incentives of 166,000, which is an incredible amount of money, for an organization that is barely operational. Then also, simply because we've crossed this man before somewhere else on one of our other entities, and he resigned from another board, we have one director here Mr. Koplaki, who earns his director's fees or his salaries are more than the chairman's. Why is that so? He's also, you know, racked up quite a good lot of travelling expenses. Yeah, so my concern is that this is far too grandiose for the amount of money that's available, and there's, you know, one needs to know that there's perhaps some other plan for them, because yeah, I don't think it should exist as a separate entity.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, can you please explain about the vacancies, about the two vacancies, about the top management? And then can you please explain about the CFO status? Thank you.
Do we have the CFO? Okay, sorry.
About that.
Thanks a lot. Did you want to comment now or after the respondent? Because I remember you had your hand up.
Honorable Chairperson, I can comment. One of the things that we always raise with the entities is that when you finalize your APP, it has to be based on what has already been allocated. Anything outside what has been allocated, there is a process that we follow with Treasury through the MTF and all of that. Once we do get a sense of what Treasury says from an allocation point of view, we then do inform entities that, you know, we went through this process, Treasury has allocated this, now start the process of implementing, not the other way around. So I think this is something that we keep hovering with the entities. Of course, the department also has got those same problems where you find, you know, did certain programs, they would have certain aspirations, but at the end of the day, we always say, it's good to have aspirations, but realities are, you have to work with your baseline.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will come back to the budget issues. I think what we have to understand, this is not a new initiative, a new idea. I think it was approved by the department in 2008. It was since then a flagship project in the department, and we've submitted business models and business plan. I mean, the one that we've submitted now is another one, and I think that I understand you know, processes in government, I think fairly okay. The problem is that we're getting more money at this point in time, and I also understand that we have merged, we've integrated entities here. NAMISA had a budget of 37 million rand for quite a number of years, and most of that money, you know, going to infrastructure and overheads and so on. So we have now a new entity where we have brought into the mix an e-skills institute that was a branch in the department, approved without budget, and I don't even have a secretary in the branch. And also brought on into this mix ISA, the Institute for Social for Software and Space Applications. So it's a very complex thing, and so the department has been aware of what is being established over quite a number of years, and also, for example, and my DG is here, and I don't want to get in a debate, but we, for the first 14-15 year, we received our 13-14 budget in November-December last year. We're still waiting for our 14-15 budget, and we had to carry over and maneuver. If it was not for the hosting universities, we would not have been possible to deliver anything, because the universities understand the importance of this model and of what we're doing. So they say, well, you know, for the goodwill
and for the importance of this project, let us support as far as possible. I've been promised, for example, in May this year, with a meeting with the then deputy minister, that money will be transferred tomorrow. We still don't have budget. And then I worked very closely with departments. I'm working with the private sector. I think for the past couple of months, we got into the kitty by way of in-kind support from the private sector and other institutions, over 32 million rand. We're waiting for 6 million rand to be transferred because I have to manage a operational thing that has been supported by the United Nations Development Program, supported by the World Bank, supported by big companies in this country. We just had a major project of 5 million rand with IBM International, researching many of the issues to the point where we now know exactly what it will take to establish a collab in the Northwest Province to be hosted by the Northwest University in Mahikeng. So collaboration, looking at other avenues of funding, and the only funding that we don't get is from the department. So and we need that money to leverage more. If we don't have money from a department that we can, then we can't operate. So I think we need to understand the budget issue. It's not that I don't understand budget processes, but this is a 5-6 year old program in this department. And as I said, the policy direction at that time, the decision was made to establish an e-skills institute on the basis of a recommendation of the then International Advisory Council of the then president. So there was the seed was there. So we're working now in our business case, and the Deputy Minister is right. How do we now, going forward with enabling legislation, that will mean a lot in terms of how. I hear Honourable Member Shin, where is this thing going to be? I think if it's this is a project, a program that has been recommended by the ITU to countries in Africa, this model that we've developed and what we can deliver with the appropriate support from a department. So in other words, it's not something we're working at a very high level. It is unique, and this year 2014 in Europe is declared e-skills for jobs. So it's not that we duplicate what's happening in universities or any other institution. That's why universities work with us, because we don't duplicate. I think that I can understand, and we have this discussion time and again, where should this thing be? In higher education and training, basic education, but if you look at the report and the environment that we've created, it's not a higher education institution. It's not a basic education institution. It's a hybrid new 21st century model that we've developed and that we have benchmarked across the world. And at this point in time, we're developing concepts here that we're exporting as proudly South African. So I think the model is there. The issue is just how do we mobilize resources, and I think the private sector is very, very willing to come on board. We had this week, we had meetings with Google, and we had meetings with Intel, all wanting to put forward what they think as ICT skills developments in the country, to rather give it a new perspective of e-skills. So I think the collaboration and the finding of additional resources, that is not the issue. I think we just have to, because I can't plan on the basis of funding coming from elsewhere, and it's very, very difficult to plan you know, even for next year, if you did not get funding for this year. I will ask Moira then to deal with the issues relating to the finances.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I think maybe just to add on some of the things that Dr. Faisal was covering, I think it's very important that we also remind the members, like I mentioned when we started the presentation, to say that we had the challenge that much as we, if members remember in the past with NEMISA, we were only getting a budget of between 37 and 39 million. And for that, we'd have to cater in terms of the, educating about 135 students, housing them, providing them with accommodation, with food, with sometimes with toiletry, with 37 or 39 million. And now, we found ourselves in a situation that we still needed to carry out that mandate of training the 135 students, but at the same time, take over the EFI and ESA, and still carry out the mandate or the APP for the new institute. And those are some of the challenges. And without trying to point fingers and say that who didn't do what and whatever, at the end of the day, there was not, we had a big dream and we had big objectives to meet. And yes, with the department, we sat down and said that the budget that we currently have and the expectations that we have from the department in terms of monetary and the finances, it was just too much for the department. And we found ways, we've cut down on our expectations. Our 2014-15 APP has scaled down, and we've tried to cut down on some of the costs. Thank you.
Just see if you want to respond to me.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regards to the questions that we got from members, I'm going to start with the salaries. On the 13th check, the 13th check for us is the total cost to company for an employee. So when we get you on, you have to give you a total cost to a company. And then you choose whether you want to leave a portion for a 13th check or not. So that is a provision that you see there. It's a provision for probably the until the end of the financial year, March. So those are for employees that actually structure their salaries to include a 13th check. Not everyone gets a 13th check. So it's with regards to how you structure your salary and then how we provide for it because there's a timing difference. With regards to the incentives, we also elaborated also on page, I think it's 60, just a second. On a human resources report, I think it was page 43. Page 49. Yes, thank you, Chair. On page 49, we have elaborated on the performance rewards. So you can see that which bands were actually paid performance rewards with regards to performance reward to performance. You have to another thing that. The APP does is that it's an integrated APP, so it's shared between us and the department. So with regards to the elements of teaching and learning at NEMISA, so we had four strategic objectives, which is teaching and learning, multi-stakeholder collaboration, and administration. The portion that the section NEMISA is responsible for, they actually achieved the training of in terms of radio and TV and graphic design and animation. So those teaching and learning stuff you could see from professional qualified skilled and semi-skilled, they were paid about a 1% of our budget with regards to incentives. So that is also tabled on page 50 of the human resources report. The other aspect that we spoke about was about the PPE with the property plant equipment, the insurance. One of the biggest challenges about the uniqueness of NEMISA is that it has to emulate almost a working environment. So which means that if you're going to be teaching radio and TV, you must have radio and TV studios. So we have what we call radio and TV studios, radio equipment, TV equipment, very expensive equipment that we keep at our offices in Parktown. That's what's making our insurance very, very expensive, because the kids have to be, we have a period of a year. I mean, to give you an example, the radio qualification is a year, qualification that a student must be exposed to editing environment, as TV, a recording environment. So we have those kind of equipment that you would actually get in terms of the in community radio stations and community TV stations, and also the SABC. So they don't see this equipment for first time. So our curriculum actually provides for 60% of practical knowledge from the students. So that's why we've got all this equipment, and that's why it's expensive. With regards to directors' emoluments, we actually highlighted, from on the DIP directors' reports, we actually have put out how much is actually in terms of directors' emoluments, and the member is quite correct. It's 4 million. And what's included in the 4 million is non-executive directors, executive directors, and also senior management as a whole. So we actually have portions. You can see there that how much we've paid for non-executive directors and how much we've paid for executive directors and how much we've actually paid for the executives as a whole, and how much is an average pair actually an executive. The other aspect that members we have also covered in the corporate governance report is with regards to meetings and the meaning of how we had the meetings of different committees and the board. And one of the challenges that we have is that because it was a new institution, there was a lot of information and a lot of things that had to be done to be put in place, and directors had to meet more regularly than usual with regards to appointment of the CEO post, for example, with regards to how do we actually get how do we resolve in terms of scaling down of our strategic planning? How do we have our strategic planning sessions going forward, and making sure that we have a realistic, more realistic strategic plan? So those are the kind of things that would influence the directors' meetings. And directors are paid per meeting attendance and what meeting they attend. And if they're not, that's why you'd probably find one director would be paid more than the others. It's actually dependent. And the number of meetings that each director has attended would be detailed in the corporate governance report. So members can be able to reconcile between what was paid to which director in reconciliation with the that report to the directors on the annual financial statements. Invoicing of students within 90 days, I think that we have highlighted that our action plan last year had been we hand over the students. We cannot restrict people from coming in to our institution, but it has been difficult because the socio-economic environment and the caliber of the students that we get, usually parents at the end of the day cannot be able to pay us. So what the strategy that we came up was to hand over what we've got, and I can make members rest assured that after we've handed over the first quarter of this year, we had 25% of our debtors paid because of that we have handed over as part of our strategy. The second strategy with regards to debtors, what we did was that we actually not allowing individuals to pay us anymore. So what we do is that we have sponsors from other institutions, as I have mentioned, that we would have MICT, CETA sponsor students, and also industry sponsor students, so that the students that we can't sponsor, so that we don't have a lot of individual debtors. And that's the strategy going forward. But the legacy strategy that we had was that we would get individuals and they will not be able to pay us. But right now we had handed over those debtors, and 25% as per the first quarter we had actually recovered that. With regards to staff cost refreshments, the whole point of us having an institute, what was unique about the institute is that it had what we have students and staff, and we have the canteen actually operating. So we actually had reduced the number of students, but we have more in terms of the canteen. And it was costing us too much, and you're right, it is costing us too much with regards to staff cost refreshments. Another thing about staff cost refreshments that we don't take out of there is projects also. Projects with regards where staff have to go to another institution to go train, and then we have to pay them for their time that week away or 2 weeks away. Those are the kind of things that actually made it more. But the strategy with the canteen is that we had to shut it down because of the model that we have now, whereby we're going to be we're trying to get because it's costing us too much with regards to buying food and everything, and it's not actually leveraged by the amount of students that we've got. So that model, we actually made sure that we had to get rid of a canteen. And with regards to the staff also, we actually looked into how we can actually make sure that we have part-time lecturers actually operating in different provinces instead of only taking a lecturers in Gauteng to go teach around the provinces. So that would actually solve our problems there. But something that we actually had a look at, and we would make sure that it doesn't actually occur again. Use of consultants, Chairperson. The use of consultants, the only consultants that we have is probably with regards to just off the top of my head, we have, in terms of accounting systems, VIP payroll, caseware, and also paying of licenses. We do not have, other than outsourced services like our internal auditors, our security, our cleaning, we do not have such major consultants. Those are the ones that when we started with the program on clean administration, the first thing that we made sure is that we don't have a lot of consultants. So one that just comes to mind is that we have our accounting systems that we have to pay licenses for. We have our VIP payroll, which is our payroll system, and our HR system that we have to pay licenses for. And over and above that, when we embarked on a process of finding a CEO, we also used a service provider to assist us with regards to response handling of the CVs and everything. So that's part of the consultants, but we do not actually have consultants in terms of assisting us with performance information. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, thanks. I just want to highlight some few things from my side. First is the implication of the current environment on the new institution, Kampa. That's what I'm concerned about here. But because we're still dealing with the annual report of NIMESA, and when I looked at the annual report at that particular time, I was hoping that these are old matters that could have been laid down. But when Dr. Veso is speaking, it looks like some of the issues are overlapping into the new process or the institution itself. And Chairperson, even the issue of the appointment, I hope the appointment is for the income of the CEO. And that process and all that, because if we can't, and this is what also the age is raising, just that synergy, that work, because it becomes difficult when I'm sitting here to be able to tangibly say this is what. So for me, I think it means for now, Ikamva, go back to the drawing board, I think, with the department. Let's rework on what is it that you want to achieve? What is your role as an institute? And what is it needed for you to be able to achieve that? Because I think that there's a bigger role. I mean, if we talk about the skills that needs to be developed in terms of the future for this country, the targets that are there, NDP speaks about training and development. All those programs, skill is very important. So we've got to be, if we say DM, this is the driver of our e-skill, it has to reflect what we are seeing. In an essence, let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's reflect in how we coordinate, we give direction to this institution. Because I'm sitting very uncomfortably where I am about this institution. then it makes it difficult what you want to do with it. Because if we are saying, okay, fine, because one of the things I would ask DM is that if these things is not what we expect, because Minister has signed off this performance, annual performance, so he's binding himself to what is written in here, unless if he had raised these issues. Or even that's why there needs to be engagement between the department and the entity, even prior to it coming here, so that wherever there's differences, they are clarified. DG, and I hope when they have strategy, they're inviting you as the department to participate so that you can give that direction, that this is where we need to do, these are the things, so that when they come in early next year, and I think we'd have to have, just that this year our program is already tight, I think there is a need for us to have a discussion around IGAMBA as an institute, look at the progress of the process of this merger, where it is, what are the issues, what are the implications. I think there is that need, and maybe we'll look at natural, let's look at our program at the beginning of the year next year, to just have an engagement before we come to annual plans. Just have a sense of where it is, because at times mergers as well, they take time and there are hiccups, so that we can monitor what is happening. Did you want to say something?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Maybe quickly, all the issues that you are raising, those were the issues that have been raised by the Minister, where Minister has put in a plan in terms of what we should address. Dr. Bese is aware of Minister's intervention, including the Chair. Maybe what we could do through the Minister is just to give you an update how Minister has intervened on the matter. What you're saying is exactly what Minister has said.
So, okay. Thank you, Chair. I think there is a slight difference between what the Chair and the DG is saying. If I hear you well, you are saying to us, let's go back and look at this entity in terms of its history, what it's meant to do, what was intended with the merger. Then strategically then, be able to advise how we locate it. For instance, at a personal level, sometimes I've listened and said, I wish it was a community college. Because with all the things you are saying in creating an information society, we need people who are skilled all over the country to be able, when we talk broadband, to have the skills to reach out. All the things you are saying we'll be doing, including changes in television space, conversions, everything. So we're more or less, I think, DG, if I understand the Chair very well, let's be clear ourselves that what was the measure meant to achieve. And if I hear members saying, cut it down, streamline it, find a niche for it, I think that's what the Chair is trying to say. I know how excited the Minister was after visiting the centre. He felt it could get us somewhere, but we must, through a strategic session, get it to where it's supposed to be. I think there's just a slight understanding of the money, but Chair, I fully agree that we have to do something quickly.
Yeah.
No, thanks, DM. I think we'll definitely have an interaction with the entity just early at the beginning, earlier next year, so that we close on the matters. Members, can I take the next presentation? So Honourable McKenzie is looking at me with another eye and saying, what is the issue? They didn't answer your question.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, not satisfactory. And I'll accept the answer on the catering in the interest of going forward. In terms of insurance, and let me come back to this here, CFO, in terms of the insurance, it's 1,455,000 for equipment that's valued, and if you said television and radio equipment, if I look at the carrying value, it's less than R1 million. So we're paying R1.5 million insurance for equipment that's worth less than R1 million. It's that's incongruent to me. I don't see that as a smart expenditure. The total value, the total carrying value of all the assets is 2,861,000, and we're paying 1.5 million insurance on that. And sorry, Chairperson, if I can just, with your indulgence, there's also property rates and taxes as a line item, 1,397,000 rand. But as far as I can see, you don't own any property. So why are you paying rates and taxes? Sorry, Chairperson, I said to put that one in. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Yes, the recent taxes also includes the branch that we've got in Franschhoek. The Franschhoek branch is a building that we've got that was donated by one of the service providers in terms of ICT training. So it was an ICT building that is being was donated to the institution for it to carry on with the work that they've been doing here. It's a building that we actually had many years ago, so we are continuing with that. So
you're meaning that you have not declared an asset?
With regards to declaration, sorry, Jefferson.
It's not there. No, we're not saying. You're saying that in terms of your financial and all those things, you do not have assets.
But in terms of the financials, we have put it down as one of the buildings that's on the financials. It's there. So we have a building that we've got. It's on note. I'll tell you now. It's on note, page 85. We have a building there with the cost evaluation. The cost evaluation is based only on the money that we had to pay in terms of that, not necessarily what the building actually costs. Because it was a donation. So it's there on page 85 on note 5. I don't know.
Just a clarity-seeking question. You've got land and buildings, indeed you have. Listed cost valuation 2014, 189,000. I couldn't buy a garage or a parking space in Franschhoek for 189,000. Then surely that is a mistake.
Mr. McKenzie,
thank you.
The property is donated, so they have not bought the property.
In your asset register, it would be reflected as a valuation. So if you have an asset that's valued at 5 million, you can't state it at 189,000, surely.
It depends. The valuation is based on what accounting principle you're going to take it at. So we didn't actually do a revaluation model, but rather a cost model. And with the cost model that we're choosing, it's we actually took it at the price that cost us for the transfer of the property. And we have also stated on page 66 about the building and what kind of model we're using and why we're using that model, and also it's on our accounting policies. So all that information is there, but we didn't, just to clarify, we did not buy the building, it was donated.
That's fine. Thank you very much for your presentation. You'll definitely hear from us. We want to have a further engagement in terms of the future of this entity and where we want it to be. Thanks. I think members' tea is ready if you want. We're going to proceed. Those who want to grab can stand and grab it, and all our colleagues who are here. We'll move now to CETA, a presentation, or even when they are moving to get the tea and coffee.